The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and maybe a little from Consumer Reports. We have no sponsor for this month's program, but we do appreciate all those who have sponsored us in the past. And if you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's start off with 68 Secrets Travelers Need to Know. Should have been reading these before the holidays, but and it also is follow these no-nonsense rules to take the pain out of every trip this holiday season and beyond. So it's still valid. Number one, do know what a great deal looks like. When to Fly and Buy reports from Hopper.com will tell you what price is a good deal for any given route. And Google Flights Tracked Prices feature will email you when the price of a selected itinerary has gone up or down. Number two, don't stress if you haven't booked yet. Data from the past 2 years suggests the best time to make a domestic flight for the 2017 holiday season will be between 3 and 7 weeks out, says Randy Wolfman, head of communications at the Travel Searchlight Skyscanner. It's kind of dumb to have put this in here at this point, since this actually is a December issue. Do check several online travel agencies. There's a misconception that every online travel agency, OTA, has the same fare, says George Hobika of AirFireWatchDog.com. But because they sometimes cut special deals with the airlines, it's worth it to check out them all. A site such as Kayak.com will scan multiple agencies in one search. Number four, don't overlook airlines that aren't in searches. Delta has stopped working with certain OTAs, so make sure you've seen its fares for your itinerary before you book. And you'll always have to check Southwest's website for its fares. Number five, do book through the airline. If there's not much difference in price between an airline's fare and an OTA's fare, book with the airline. In the event of a delay or a cancellation, you'll need to go back to whoever issued your ticket to get rebooked, and you could be better off if you dealt with the airline directly rather than with a third-party agent, explains Akash Gupta of thepointsguy.com. Number six, don't always book the family together. If you're buying multiple tickets, search for them individually and as a group. Airline ticket prices are full of quirks, and sometimes individual seats are cheaper than a block. If you decide to buy individually, make sure there's no per-ticket processing charge that would offset the savings. Number seven, do fly on Christmas. If dinner doesn't hit the table until early evening, consider flying on Christmas morning to save an average of $50 per person compared with traveling on Friday preceding the holiday. Depart before that Friday to cut costs further. Flights on Wednesday, December 20th and Wednesday, December 27th are likely to have the deepest discounts this season, according to CheapAir.com. Number eight, don't ignore air plus hotel bundles. Booking both at the same time may cost a lot less than booking separately. If the hotel doesn't have to show their price and the airlines don't have to show their price, both are willing to give lower prices not available otherwise, Tim McDonald, former general manager of Expedia.com, told the New York Times. Do subscribe to a newsletter. Airlines often offer discounts via email. Put your name on their list and you'll be in the know about promo codes, flash sales, and other special offers. We've seen discounts of up to 50% on certain airlines and routes. Number 10. Don't miss out on fare drop refunds. The law requires airlines to allow you to rebook your flight for free within 24 hours of buying your ticket, as long as you're more than a week from the departure date. After that, most airlines charge up to $200 to change flights, but Southwest will never charge a fee. Number 11, do review your group memberships. AARP members get up to 10% off at many hotel chains and up to 25% off some car rentals. AAA offers similar deals. One surprising source of discounts, Costco. It offers its members deals on cars and hotels as well as on some excellent vacation packages. Many employers also offer airline and hotel discounts. Pain relief. Number 12. Don't sit with your knees in your chin. JetBlue offers the most legroom in economy, according to Consumer Reports. Each airline has its own signature amenity, so you might want to shop accordingly. For instance, if in-flight entertainment is your priority, opt for Virgin America, which offers free Wi-Fi, movies, and television shows. Number 13. Do be a very early bird. Delays inevitably stack up over the course of the day. The earlier in the morning you fly, the better chance you have of avoiding them. Number 14. Don't go near the cold if you can help it. If you have connecting flights, choose warm weather cities for your layovers. Phoenix and Atlanta are less susceptible to severe winter weather, however, Atlanta is susceptible to power failures, and the flight delays and cancellations it often brings, than, say, Chicago or Denver. 15. Do pop a Pepto-Bismol. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says travelers can reduce the risk of intestinal trouble by about 50% by taking Pepto-Bismol or Kaopectate preventively, either two chewable tablets or 2 ounces of liquid, 4 times a day. If you have other health conditions, check with your doctor first. Number 16. Don't forget to check in the night before. If you end up getting to the airport late, the airline is more likely to give away your seat if you haven't checked in. Hack your bags. That's hack, not pack. 17. Do work out a color scheme. I wear black almost exclusively when I travel, says flight attendant Carol Mulder. If that feels too solemn for your holiday festivities, try planning your outfits around a cheerier color. The goal is to be able to mix and match a good number of outfits, so you need fewer articles of clothing overall. 18. Don't pack the way Santa does. Shop online and ship gifts directly to your destination, especially if you're staying with friends or family and can easily do your wrapping there. Number 19. Do seal in freshness. Top the inside of your suitcase with a dryer sheet. Your clothes will smell laundry fresh when you arrive at your destination. Number 20. Don't walk on your clothes. Put your shoes in a shower cap before you pack them, and you'll need dirty footprints on your clean duds. Number 21. Do protect with plastic. I'll even ziplock my clothes, says Mulder. It's much cheaper to wrap up that fancy Christmas party outfit than it is to buy a new one if your moisturizer explodes. Number 22. Don't use a purse as your personal item. To maximize what you can take on board, use a tote or a backpack as your personal item. If you still want your purse with you, slip it inside the larger bag. Number 23. Do get a shampoo bar. Lush Cosmetics offers one for $10.95 that lasts 3 times as long as a bottle of shampoo and won't be confiscated by the TSA. Plus, it can't leak. 24. Don't lose track of your bag. The TileApp.com, $25, is a Bluetooth device that sends a signal from your bag or whatever you attach it to your phone. It has a range of up to 200 feet, depending on the model, enough to alert you when your suitcase is approaching the baggage claim. At the airport, 25. Don't buy water. Most airports have filtered water systems, says Jeanette Panini, savings expert at Coupons.com. Bring an empty refillable water through security and then fill it at the terminal. 26. Don't sit near the airport lounge. You might be able to hop on the lounge's Wi-Fi if the airport doesn't provide any. Do sit near the airport lounge. Fixes FoxNomad.com for a map with Wi-Fi passwords for airports around the world. 27. Don't buy electronics. Headphones at the airport are especially overpriced. If you must buy them, you'll get prices closer to retail at Best Buy's kiosks, says Coleman Collins, author of The Road Warrior. 28. Do read and return. Many airport bookstores are owned by the same company, and if you buy a book from one of them, you can return it to any of the chain stores for a half-price refund. Just keep your receipt and return the book within 6 months. Ask a cashier for details. Number 29. Do amuse yourself if you're delayed. The site guru lists gateguru.com lists amenities, restaurants, spas, children play areas at dozens of airports. Number 30. Don't wait for the gate agent if your flight is canceled. Instead, call the airline as you stand in line. You'll likely reach an agent faster, and he or she won't be as frazzled as the poor soul at the airport. Number 31. Surviving with the family. Don't let a squabble get out of hand. According to family therapist Hal Runkel, the word ouch can stop an argument in its tracks. Say ouch. That one hurt. I don't know whether you were meaning to hurt me, but that's what you did, Runkel tells Business Insider Australia. This wake-up call can get you back in the core issue and away from the hurtful territory. 32. Do suggest ways to help. Everyone has one relative who never pitches in. Give Uncle Lazybones the benefit of the doubt and assume he doesn't know how to help. Then offer suggestions for Ansel. For example, Uncle, I'll leave the laundry detergent on top of the washer should you need it. Number 33. Don't get into it with adult children. Whether they've been out of the house for 5 years or 50, trust adult children to make their own decisions, even if you disagree. Comments about your children's parenting strategies or how they split their holiday time with their spouses' families can be especially sensitive. Number 34. Do skip a little of the fun. One study by consumer behaviorists found that interrupting a pleasant experience with a less pleasant one can intensify a person's overall enjoyment. Tackle one annoying task, such as starting your taxes, and the contrast will remind you how special vacation time with the family can be. Wheels up! Number 35. Do speak up if you're afraid to fly. Tell a flight attendant and he or she will keep an eye on you, says Mulder. That can mean anything from a few calming words to a complimentary glass of wine. Number 36. Don't skip the safety video. Even if you've seen it 100 times, watch it again. It's about safety first, of course, but some of them are actually fun now, as the airlines have been putting on a talent competition with their videos lately. Virgin American looks like something from MTV. 37. Do count the rows to the nearest emergency exit. Yes, it's a worst-case scenario thing to do, but if the plane should have problems, the cabin could fill with smoke and become difficult to navigate. Making a mental note of how far you need to go, based on the exit, could save your life. Number 38. Don't sleep through takeoff and landing. Your limited ability to pop your ears, which could lead to pain, if even moderate to severe hearing loss. 39. Do give the kids a lollipop. If they are too young for chewing gum, sucking on a lollipop will retrieve pressure in their ears. It's all about swallowing frequently. 40. Don't get dehydrated. Not all flight-induced headaches are caused by increased air pressure. It's really easy to get dehydrated in the events leading up to the flight, says Mulder. Drink 8 ounces of water for every hour in the air. 41. Try this turbulence trick. Jigger your body slightly when you hit rough air, suggests Janie Wortley, a public relations consultant at skycanner.com. Your movement will counteract that of the plane and help you feel less jostled around. Don't be self-conscious. The plane will be making the other's passengers jiggle a little, too. Number 42. Don't close the air vent. Keep it open to create an air current that blows germs away from you, increasing the odds that you'll stay healthy. That said, use a tissue to touch the vent. Research has shown it's one of the dirtiest spots on the airplane. It's nice to know. 43. Do take a hike. Sitting for too long in a confined space can lead to potentially harmful blood clots. The CDC recommends getting up and walking around the cabin every 2 or 3 hours to reduce the risk. And don't cross your legs while you're sitting. Number 44. Don't catch a cold. One study found that close quarters and low cabin humidity, which lowers immunity, makes you 113 times more likely to catch a cold on a plane than on an ordinary day. Keep your nose moisturized to ward off germs with a saline nasal spray and use hand sanitizer frequently. 45. Do ask about switching seats. One study found that sitting within 2 rows of someone with flu-like symptoms increases your chance of getting sick by 3.6%. Sit within 2 seats of the 6th passenger and your chance of coming down with the flu goes up by 7.7%. If there's room, quietly ask the flight attendant if a move might be possible. 46. Don't hurt your back. Using a lumbar pillow or a rolled-up jacket to support your lower back can work wonders. Also, keeping your arms on the armrest will alleviate pressure on your back. 47. Do make the airplane food taste a little less bland. The key here is to wear headphones. Oxford University professor of experimental psychology Charles Spencer says that the sound of the plane's engines can contribute to flyers' inability to taste and smell food. Wearing nose-canceling headphones could mitigate that, he says. 48. Don't use your U-shaped pillow as directed. Pushing it backward to prevent your chin from falling forward should you nod off. Also, spray it with lavender linen spray for a soothing scent that could help you fall to sleep faster. Driver's Ed. 49. Do add your own shock absorbers. If your journey entails a long drive, consider purchasing padding or seat cushions. Full-seam phone options are available for as little as $30. Number 50, don't eat candy. It might give you quick energy boost, but it wears off fast. Opt for a healthy, protein-rich snack, such as nuts, to rejuvenate yourself without the sugar crash. Number 51, do stop more often than you used to. Every 2 hours or so, stop to stretch your legs and rest your eyes. Even if you don't have time for a nap while you stop, the change of pace will keep you more alert once you set off again. And there's a picture of a steering wheel with a melted chocolate bar dripping on it. 52. Don't take breaks while traffic is moving. You'll need to stop, but save gas by doing it during rush hour. Stop-and-go traffic drains your mileage as well as your patience. 53. Do hang a shoe organizer over the seat. Especially if you've got kids, it's a great way to organize first aid items, snacks, books, and electronics. 54. Don't drink and drive, even non-alcoholic beverages. A study by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration found that distracted driving, which includes drinking and eating at the wheel, causes 80% of crashes. Hot coffee, which has a tendency to spill, is a major no-no. Chocolate is too, since it easily becomes a melted mess. 55. Do consider ditching the car. Need to decide between renting a car and relying on taxis? If the longest distance you're traveling is between the airport and where you're staying, you're probably better off using cabs or services such as Uber and Lyft. Get a room. 56. Don't be shy about bargaining. Find the best hotel deal you can online and then call the hotel directory and ask if it can beat what you found, says Pavini. Booking with a hotel will give you more flexibility should you need to change your reservation, and talking to a person gives you a higher chance of nabbing an upgrade. 57. Do bring up a special occasion. Celebrating a birthday or an anniversary? Tell the booking agent. They'll make note of that in your reservation, and you will often get an upgrade when you check in, says Pavini. 58. Don't skip the rewards clubs. They're free, and they get you perks such as free Wi-Fi, priority check-in, late checkout, and points towards future free stays. If you're not a member, mention that when you book your room, says Pavini. Say, if I join now, can you upgrade me, or what, can I get a better deal? 59. Do ask about the airport shuttle. Many guests find out their hotel offers a complimentary one only after they've arrived. 60. Don't get stuck in a noisy room. Especially around the holidays, other guests might gather before parties or return from them in the wee hours. Rooms in the middle of a floor are generally the quietest, since they're not near the elevators, ice machines, or cleaning closets. 61. Do look into vacation rentals. Airbnb, HomeAway, and other short-term rentals are great options, especially if they can take the place of renting several hotel rooms for big families. But be careful. This type of accommodation isn't legal everywhere, and you could be evicted mid-stay if your rental isn't up to code. New York City and New Orleans are among the destinations that put restrictions on renting a person's private home. 62. Don't use the ice bucket. Home to cool, moist contents, hotel ice buckets can easily become breeding grounds for germs, says Jennifer Stagg, M.D. Use the plastic liner that comes with the bucket, or ask for one if it doesn't. 63. Do remove the bedspread ASAP. It might be changed only 4 times a year, Renetta McCarthy, a former housekeeping manager for a major American hotel chain, told HuffingtonPost.com. 64. Don't forget the rule of opposites. In general, you'll want to book business hotels during their downtime on weekends and resort hotels during theirs on weekdays. Sunday, which isn't in demand or business or leisure travelers, is almost always the cheapest night to book. 65. Do peel an orange when you arrive. Hotel rooms can smell a little antiseptic. Peeling an orange will give off a naturally clean and homey aroma. 66. Don't suffer with dry air. Because of climate-controlled rooms and windows that don't open, the air in hotels can be dry. If your room has a kitchen area, heat water in a tea kettle and let the steam escape into the room until most of the water has evaporated. Or run water over a towel and hang it near the air vent. 67. Do try a DIY price drop. Notice that the price dropped on home rooms at your hotel? Book it, then cancel your old reservation. Most hotels will let you cancel within 48 or even 24 hours before your arrival date. Check your booking terms first. 68. Don't order room service. Sure, it can be fun and even a bit romantic, but room service is also pricey. Save money by having food delivered from a local eatery. Seamless or Grubhub will show you what's nearby. It'll most likely taste better, too. Part of your balanced breakfast. The reality is a vanilla soy latte is a type of three-bean soup. A woman is an exclusive... This is laughter the best medicine. A woman is in an exclusive pet store looking to buy a sweater for her dog. After witnessing much hemming and hawing and the scrutinizing of the size of each item, the salesperson finally pipes in. "Why don't you bring the dog in for a fitting?" she says. "I can't do that," the customer says. "The sweater is a surprise." "On the 13th day of Christmas, my true love said to me, 'I think I might be a hoarder.'" A turtle crossing the road when he's mugged by two snails. When the police show up to investigate, they ask him what happened. The shaken turtle replies, "I don't know. It all happened so fast." Late show host Stephen Colbert has a few things he'd like to confess. "Sometimes when I'm out to dinner with my wife, I'll propose so we'll get free dessert. I like being an adult, but I wish all my shoes were Velcro. When I go into McDonald's, that has the cowards printed on the menu. I pretend they're points and I'm going to win. Sometimes I lie awake at night afraid I'll die before I get to use all my forever stamps. Sometimes I wish I had more health problems because the people in pharmaceutical ads have more picnics than I do." An elderly woman lived in Canada near the North Dakota border. One day her son ran into the house holding a letter. "Mom," he said, "the government has decided that our land is really part of the United States. We can choose whether we're Americans or Canadians." "We'll say we're Americans," his mother said. "I couldn't stand another one of those Canadian winters." Prince Philip looks out the window on Christmas Eve. "That's some reindeer," he says. The Queen replies, "63 years. Yes, it... that is a lot. I'm not quite sure if I understand that." Oh, yes, I do. "That's some reindeer." Sorry about that. I kind of trying to figure out what that was. Now we're cooking. Billion-dollar ID. A smoke director that shuts off when you yell, "I'm just cooking!" I never realized how much parenthood would involve competing with the dog for my kids' leftover fries. A lady posted her grandmother's brownie recipe, so I tried making them. Turns out her grandmother was a terrible baker. Relationship status. My wife asked me what I wanted for dinner, and then told me I was wrong. I wanted to go out tonight, but the avocado I bought this week will finally be ripe enough to eat between 8 p.m. and 8:15 p.m., so I can't. Just ate a burrito so big that I had to forget algebra to make room. Cheese, the adult form of milk. The stranger who changed my life. When an encyclopedia misprint brings two book lovers together, the only thing that stands between them is the bars of a Maryland prison. The prisoner and the encyclopedia editor. One day, in mid-2016, Robin Woods drove 7 hours from at home in Maryland to visit a man named Mark Stevens in Amherst, Massachusetts. The two had corresponded for years, and they'd spoken on the phone dozens of times, but they had never met in person. Woods, who was bald and broad-shouldered, parked his car and walked along a tree-lined street to Stevens' house. He seemed nervous and excited as he knocked on the door. A wiry man with white hair and glasses opened it. Within a few minutes, Woods, 54, and Stevens, 66, were sitting in the living room talking about books. The conversation seemed both apt and improbable. When Woods had first written to Stevens in 2004, he was serving a 16-year prison sentence in Jessup, Maryland, for breaking and entering. And yet, it was a book that had brought them together. At Jessup, Woods had bought and begun reading Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Encyclopedia, a nearly 5-pound tome that starts with an entry on the German city of Aachen and ends with Isomogen, an inactive protein precursor to enzymes. He hoped to read all of the alphabetical entries, which exceeded 25,000, and he spent hours flipping through the pages. One day, he was puzzled to read an entry that the 11th-century ruler Toghil Beg had entered Baghdad in 1955. He quickly realized that it should have been 1055. "I read it several times to make sure," he said. Then he turned to the masthead, which listed the editor, Mark A. Stevens. Dear Mr. Stevens, Woods wrote in a letter, I am writing to you at this time to advise you of a misprint in your fine Catalogic Encyclopedia. He described the error and offered his thanks for Merriam-Webster's reference books. I would be lost without them, he wrote, unsure whether he'd ever get a response. What Woods didn't mention in the first letter to Stevens was the encyclopedia represented the culmination of his self-education. Woods grew up in a housing project in Cumberland, Maryland. Cumberland was once an industrial center, but has become one of the poorest metropolitan areas in America. Woods was first sent to prison at 23 for firing his grandfather's rifle through an apartment window after a drug-related dispute. He was young, embittered, and almost completely illiterate. I had never read a book in my life, he says. Wood remembers enjoying first grade, but he says he was bullied because of his light skin. Woods was raised by his mother, who was African-American. His father was of mixed race. In second grade, he developed an antagonistic relationship with his teacher, who made him sit in a coat closet whenever he annoyed her. Eventually, the school transferred him to a special education program. As he progressed through the grades, instead of learning to read and write, he was given chores, such as collecting attendance slips and stacking milk in the cafeteria refrigerator. These tasks earned him mostly A's and B's. Of course, I didn't learn nothing, he says. They say it takes a community to raise a child. It takes one to destroy a child, too. Woods ultimately dropped out of high school. During his first stint in prison, Woods began his own course of study. He was sent to a notoriously harsh prison in Hagerstown, Maryland. He resented authority figures and often directed outbursts at the guards, who responded by putting him on lockup. For 23 hours at a time, and sometimes longer, Woods be alone in his cell that had no television or radio. One day a man with a cart of books wound his way through the lockup tiers, shouting, "Library call!" Woods wasn't interested at first, but his boredom won out. He decided to borrow the autobiography of Malcolm X and The Sicilian, a mafia novel by Mario Puzo. The autobiography proved too complicated, and The Sicilian was only slightly easier. Still, Woods persisted. Many, many words I had to skip over because I couldn't read them, Woods recalls. Each page took him about 5 minutes, but left him with a glow of accomplishment. By the time he got to the end, about a week had passed. I remember that I wept, Woods says, not because of what he had read, but because he had succeeded in reading something. Woods soon brought his first dictionary at the prison commissary and began etching words into his memory by copying them down and reading them aloud. He read into the early hours of the morning. Even though I was confined in a cell, my mind was free, Woods says. I could escape. For a brief time, Woods also regained his physical freedom in 1987. He finished his sentence and moved back into Cumberland, where he lived in a shack and worked occasionally for a man who cleaned offices. Books had expanded Woods' world, but they hadn't made it any easier for him to stay out of trouble. One night, Woods says he drove to one of the offices he helped clean, knocked out a window, and stole several $1,000s worth of equipment. The next day, he went to a local club and, over a game of pool, tried to sell some of the equipment. When a group of state troopers walked in the side door, he didn't put up a fight. Not even 2 years had passed since his release, and Woods was once again incarcerated at the prison in Hagerstown, an institution he had become to detest. Because of his prior record, Woods received a harsh sentence, 16 years for 2 counts of breaking and entering. In 1991, after Woods got caught up in a prison riot, his sentence was extended by 7 years. There are a few ways that books enter prisons. They're sold at prison commissaries and lent by prison libraries. Nonprofits also distribute donated books to prisoners. There are state and federal restrictions, of course. In some institutions, hardcover books may be sent to an inmate only if they're from a publisher, a book club, or a bookstore. The U.S. Bureau of Prisons also prohibits texts that are detrimental to security, good order, or discipline of the institution, or that may facilitate criminal activity. Many prisons also add their own idiosyncratic rules. Even so, Woods managed to assemble a small library in his cell. A lot of prisons put emphasis on how many Nike shoes they have, he says. I would wear a pair of prison's tennis shoes if necessary, but I had $800 or $900 worth of books. Woods ordered his encyclopedia through the mail after reading about it in a catalog. When it arrived, he says, it was carefully inspected for contraband. In late November 2004, when Mark Stephen received his first letter from Robin Woods, He responded on Merriam-Webster Incorporated letterhead. I believe you're the first to have spotted the error in the Torger Borg entry. By 1955, Torger was no longer exactly at his prime, Stevens wrote. Please stay on the lookout for more. Wish was thrilled, and soon he wrote again, highlighting errors in the entries for Edward the Confessor and Uthman ibn Affan. Not as a critic, but as a friend, he explained in his letter. For I believe that MWI is the creme de la creme, and I would like to help it stay that way. Over the next 2 years, Stevens sent 18 letters to Woods. Woods sent several dozens to Stevens. They discussed the life of Cleopatra and the self-education of Malcolm X. But Woods barely discussed his criminal record, and Stevens never asked. They were perfectly executed letters and very courteous, Stevens said. Still, it seems astonishing to me, one letter concluded. I have the honor to be, sir, your most obedient servant. But in 2005, it seemed as if all that was about to change. Woods learned that he would be transferred, without a clear explanation, to a supermax prison in Baltimore. Officials told him he wouldn't be able to bring his books. Woods protested. Within days of arriving at his new cell, he went on a hunger strike. I've gone crazy and will not eat until they allow me to keep my books, he wrote Stevens. Several weeks later, he wrote another letter. This one short and despondent. I look like walking death, but I'm hard-headed and shall not give up. Locked in a single room, Woods lost about 70 pounds. One day, as Wood remembers it, he saw a shadow on the wall of his cell. It was the Maryland Commissioner of Corrections who asked about his health. He had a very curious look on his face, Woods recalls. Finally, the commissioner asked, who is this Mark Stevens? Woods remembered thinking, how does he know Mr. Stevens? As it turns out, Stevens had written to two prison wardens, and eventually word had gotten to the commissioner, who called him. They spoke about Woods in the encyclopedia. Not long after that, the commissioner offered Woods a deal. If he would end his hunger strike and follow the rules for a year, the commissioner would cut short the extended sentence and send Woods home. In the meantime, his books would be restored to him. I felt like a kid getting out of high school, Woods wrote to Stevens near the end of 2006. The whole world is waiting for me. In January 2007, 18 years after the start of his incarceration and 5 years before the scheduled conclusion of his extended sentence, Robin Woods was discharged from prison. He had about $50 to his name, the minimum required by law. Woods once more moved back to Cumberland, where he was given housing by a local pastor. Every few months he called Stevens. The calls continued for a decade before they finally arranged to meet. When Wood visits Stevens at his home in Amherst, in June 2016, they were soon acting like old friends. I never met you until today, but I love you very much, Wood told Stevens. You're a good man. They took hikes, went to a play, and visited the home of Emily Dixon, where a plaque quotes her lines. There is no frigate like a book to take us lands away. On Sunday, after a goodbye hug, Woods began the long drive home. Woods rarely reads anymore, partly, he says, because it takes considerable effort just to pay the bills and keep clear of the law. But he still keeps a copy of Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Encyclopedia close. While my body is here in prison, my mind has seen the world, Woods once wrote to Stevens. There are a lot of places that I hope to see that I have read about in my many books. Stevens responded by quoting another book, T.H. White's The Once and Future King. The best thing for being sad, Merlin says in the novel, is to learn something. That is the only thing that never fails. Classic poems as internet headlines. This man stopped by Woods on a snowy eve. You won't believe what happens next, by Robert Frost. I wandered lonely as a cloud until this dog's Instagram gave my life meaning, William Wordsworth. First I was like, who cares about a Grecian urn? By the end I was in tears, John Keats. We should all go gentle into that good night, right? Here are 10 reasons why you're dead wrong, by Dylan Thomas. That's outrageous. Bottoms up. If you dislike drinking alone, but your best friend is your cat, good news. There's Nye Wine available with the feline barfly in mind. Your tabby can enjoy a fine peanut meow or white kittendale from Colorado-based Apollo Peak. Or if the kitty has a refined palate, perhaps a meow and chardon from the Pet Winery in Fort Myers, Florida. The Kitty Hooch is essentially non-alcoholic, watered-down catnip, because, let's face it, cats can be bad drunks. For those who love books but hate to read hate to read, take a page from the Columbia Room in Washington, D.C. As part of a recent tasting menu, the bar served a libation made from old text. Century-old tomes were vacuum-sealed in grapeseed oil, and the infusion was washed with a natural high-proof spirit. The tincture was then combined with amagnac, sherry, and a porcini's cordial, and eucalyptus. The result, said the chief bartender, had that musty, fusty, old library quality to it. Speaking of literary mixology, book titles. It turns out, lend themselves to quirky-sounding cocktails. Tequila Mockingbird by Tim Federle is devoted to such concoctions. Among the more tortured entry, the pitcher of Dorian Gray Goose, Gray Goose Vodka Lemonade Mint. Are you there, God? It's me, Margarita. Tequila, lime juice, triple sec, and Bridget Jones's Daiquiri, strawberry, champagne, lemon juice, and granulated sugar. If you can survive the harsh Yukon winters, chances are you can stomach anything, including sour toe cocktail. It's a shot of your favorite liquor garnished with a petrified human toe. You read that right. Hard liquor is involved and a human toe. One of more than 10 that the Sourdough Saloon in Dawson City has been gifted by unfortunates who lost them to frostbite or accident. Apparently, in the Great White North, this is how they while away their winters. More than 100,000 brave souls have ordered these toenails. Medical drama. First told at a show by The Moth, the live storytelling group at the Tarrytown Music Hall in Tarrytown, New York. When one of her identical twins died shortly after he was born, a brave mother decided to donate his tissue to science. Then she followed it wherever it went. Sarah Collum in her home in Washington, D.C., being hugged by her son. She's a dark-haired lady, very attractive, and her son is blonde and giving her a big smile along with the hug. A family discovers its rare gift. I was 3 months pregnant with identical twin boys when my husband Ross and I learned that one of them had a fatal birth defect. Our son Thomas had an encephaly, which means that his skull and brain were not formed properly. Babies with this diagnosis typically die in utero or within minutes, hours, or even days of being born. The news was devastating and also confusing. I had never heard of this before, and it didn't run in my family. I wondered, was it something I ate? Was it something I drank? Was it something I did? But then, even if it was, why was one of them healthy? So I was wrestling with a lot of questions that would never have answers, and I had to make peace with that. It was like having an annoying hum in the background. 6 months later, the twins were born, and they were both born alive. Thomas lived for 6 days. Callum was healthy, and Ross and I moved on the best that we could. We had a beautiful, healthy boy to raise. We decided early on to tell Callum the truth about his brother. We have a few pictures of Thomas in our home. It was a few years later that Callum started to comprehend what we were trying to tell him. Sometimes he said things that were sad, and sometimes he said things that were kind of funny. We visit Thomas's grave a couple times a year, and one time we told Callum that we're going to bring him some flowers and put on Thomas's grave. Callum picked up his little matchbox cars and said, I want to put this on the grave too, which I thought was really sweet. And once we were there, Callum said, is Thomas scared under there? Of course, I don't really know the answer to that, you know, but I could pretend. So I said, no, he's not scared. Later on, we were on the couch watching cartoons, and Callum said, Mommy, what is it like in heaven? Again, I don't really know, so I did my best. I just said, you know, some people think it's a place you go when you die, and some people don't believe it's there. I was also curious about Thomas's afterlife, but in a totally different way. Ross and I had decided to donate Thomas's organs to science. While his death was inevitable, we thought maybe it could be productive. We learned it because he would be too small at birth to qualify for transplant. He'd be a good candidate to donate for research. We were able to donate his liver, his cord blood, his retinas, and his corneas. I was curious about these donations made a difference. A short time later, I was on a business trip in Boston. I remember that Thomas's corneas had gone to a division of Harvard Medical School called the Shepin's Eye Research Institute. So I looked, and I saw it was only a few miles from my hotel. And I thought I would love to visit this lab and learn more about where Thomas's donation went. Because I'd given them a donation, but it wasn't just signing a check or giving a bag of clothes, I'd given them the gift of my child. However, in order to donate, I had to sign away my rights to any future information about the donation. So if they did not welcome me, I would understand. Although I felt in my heart that I wanted to visit, that I should be allowed to visit, and that if I asked the right person, I might even be invited for a visit. But I also wondered if they reject me. Am I emotionally ready for that? What's that going to do to my grief? But I called. I explained to the receptionist, I donated my son's eyes to you a couple of years ago. I'm in town on business for a couple of days. Is there any chance I can stop by for a 10-minute tour? There was a pause, and lucky for me, the reception was very compassionate. She didn't laugh or say it was weird, when it was a little weird. She said, I've never had this request before. I don't know who to transfer you to, but don't hang up. I'm going to find somebody for you. Don't hang up. So she connected me to someone in donor relations. It was not an organ donor relations. It was a financial donor relations. But she knew how to give a tour, so we set an appointment. I showed up the next day, and she introduced me to one of the people who requested corneas, Dr. Jane Zieski, an associate professor of ophthalmology at Harvard Medical School. I stood in his doorway, and the donor relations woman explained who I was. Dr. Zieski was eating a salad at his desk, and he stood up and he thanked me for my donation. He shook my hand and said, Do you have any questions for me? I was so emotional at meeting him, I said, How many corneas do you request in a year? He said, My lab requests about 10 a year. We would request more, but they are hard to get, and infant eyes are like gold to us. My heart was just in my throat. I could barely choke out the words. I said, Could you tell me why? He said that infant eyes are unusual because most of us are older when we die, and that's when you donate your eyes. But unlike adult eyes, infant eyes have the potential to generate longer in the lab because the cells are younger and divide more easily. He said, If you don't mind my asking, how many years ago did your son die? I said, About 2 years ago. He said, We are likely still studying your son's eye cells, and they are probably in this lab right now. So the tour concluded, and my guide said to me, I'll never forget you. Please keep in touch with me. I felt something in me starting to change. I felt that my son had found his place in the world, and that place was Harvard. So my son got into Harvard, and I'm now an Ivy League mom. But I also got the bug, and I thought maybe I could visit the three other places, too. I made some phone calls and set up two appointments in Durham, North Carolina, and this time I took my husband and our son. Our next visit was to Duke University at the Center for Human Genetics, where the cord blood had gone. We met the director of the center, who also worked on the Human Genome Project. He explained that being able to study the blood from each twin's umbilical cord was extremely valuable to them. He was studying a field called epigenetics, which means on top of genetics. Epigenetic changes can help determine whether genes are turned on or off, and it's one of the reasons that identical twins can still be different. Our twins' cord blood was able to help the researchers establish a benchmark to learn more about how an encephaloply develops. Then we drove down the street to Cytonet, which is the place that got Thomas's liver. We met the president and eight staff members, and even the woman who held Thomas's liver in her hands. They explained to us that his liver had been used in a six-liver study to determine the best temperature at which to freeze infant liver cells for a life-saving therapy. They also said we're the only family who had ever visited. A few years later, I set up the final appointment in Philadelphia, and Rose, Ross, Callum, and I went to visit the University of Pennsylvania. That's where we met the researcher who'd received Thomas's retinas. She was studying retinoblastoma, which is a potentially deadly cancer of the retina. She explained that she had been waiting 6 years for a sample like Thomas's. It was so precious to her that she had saved some of it, and 5 years later she still had some of it in her freezer. And did we want to see it? Yes, we did. She then gave Callum a pen T-shirt, and she offered him an internship. So I thought when we made these donations, in the abstract, in the generic sense, that it was a nice thing to do. But I was amazed and blown away when I met the researchers and they told me specifically what they were doing with each donation. My feeling of grief started to turn into pride. I felt that Thomas was introducing us to his colleagues and his co-workers. He was introducing me to people I would never have met and taking me to places I never would have been. The humming that I felt in the back of my mind stopped. Recently, Ross, Callum, and I went to Philadelphia to accept an award from the National Disease Research Interchange for Advocacy. We went on stage, and Callum accepted the award. He was so proud. I took the opportunity to ask him a question. I asked, "Do you know why we're accepting this award?" And he said, "For helping people." I know that he grows older, there will be more questions, tough questions, and I'm going to have to teach him that there are some times in life when there are questions that are important, but you'll still never get the answer. But it's worth a try, and you never know until you ask. Sarah Gray is the author of A Life Everlasting, the extraordinary story of one boy's gift to medical science. And there's a picture of her with her husband, Ross, Callum, her son, and a one-year-old, Jocelyn, and the author in their living room. Who knew? 13 things you didn't know about the holiday season. Who put the X in Christmas? Turns out the Greeks did. What we English speakers know as the letter X is the same shape as the Greek letter chi. Best known for its supporting role in sorority house names as well as the Greek name for Christ. Modern speakers aren't the first to borrow Jesus' Greek name for holiday abbreviation. There's evidence of Christmas being abbreviated to Xmas as far back as the 16th century. No offense intended then or now. There is no right way to spell Hanukkah. That's because it's a Hebrew word beginning with the consonant het, which has no English equivalent. The closest is probably the throaty k sound at the end of Bach. While there's no official way to translate this in English, Google research results do declare a popular winner, Hanukkah, H-A-N-U-K-K-A-H, with about 17 million hits, soundly beats the runner-up, Chanukah, which is C-H-A-N-U-K-A-H, with a mere 4.8 million hits. Number 3, Kwanzaa, on the other hand, is intentionally misspelled. The non-religious festival, observed December 26 to January 1st, was created by Malunga Karinga in 1966 to empower the black community in the aftermath of the deadly Watts riots in Los Angeles. Modeling this holiday on traditional African harvest festivals, Karinga took the name Kwanzaa from the Swahili phrase Matahunda ya Kwanzaa, which means first fruits. The extra A was added simply to accommodate the 7 children at an early Kwanzaa celebration, each of whom wanted to represent a letter. Another holiday invented in 1966, Festivus, made famous by a 1997 episode of Seinfeld, in which the Costanza family gathers around an aluminum pole for the annual airing of grievances. This secular non-holiday was actually invented decades earlier by Reader's Digest editor Daniel O'Keefe Sr., who wanted a low-pressure way to celebrate the anniversary of his first date with his wife. Festivus became an O'Keefe family staple, and eventually a cultural icon after Dan O'Keefe Jr. shared his holiday memories with colleagues in the Seinfeld writers' room. Festivus is celebrated worldwide on December 23rd. In Korea, everyone's birthday is New Year's Day, regardless of the day anyone was actually born. Odder still, on the day you're born, you're considered to be 1 year old. So you will be considered 2 years old on the next New Year's Day of your life. While most legal records in Korea use a person's international age, the traditional age system still matters. A person can legally buy alcohol or tobacco in Korea, for example, on January 1st of the 19th year after his or her birth. Number 6. The Chinese Lunar New Year, which starts on February 16th in 2018, brings with it the largest annual migration in the world. Starting roughly 15 days before the festival and lasting 40 days, known as Chunya period, its seasonal travel rush of hundreds of millions of people returning to their hometowns to celebrate the holiday with family. In 2017, an estimated 2.98 billion passenger trips were made for the New Year festivities. Number 7. Want to celebrate Ethiopian New Year? Mark your calendar for the first Meskhetiyim. Ethiopia is the only country in the world that hasn't adopted a 12-month Gregorian calendar, instead using its own 13-month Coptic calendar, which contains 12 30-day months and a 13-month that has 5 days, except in a leap year, when it has 6. On our Gregorian calendar, Ethiopian New Year falls on September 11th, every non-leap year. Number 8. In Japan, if it's Christmas, you're eating KFC. The tradition began in 1974 after a Kentucky Fried Chicken manager overheard a couple of foreigners talking about missing the Christmas turkey. KFC embraced the opportunity, debuting a special Christmas deal, a fried chicken dinner plus wine for the equivalent of about $52. Today, families order their finger-licking good Christmas chicken weeks in advance, to the tune of about 3.6 million orders a year. Number 9, if it's Christmas in Peru, put up your dukes. Tanakuai Festival is held every Christmas day in the province of Chumbivilcas. The festival consists of dancing and fist-fighting, whether to settle old conflicts or simply to display manhood. In the United States, we try to avoid fighting on holidays, theoretically. Number 10. Krampus is the original bad Santa. For hundreds of years, this half-goat, half-demon has served as the anti-Santa in a number of European countries, including Austria, Slovenia, and the Czech Republic, encouraging kids to behave lest they be whipped, stuffed in a bag, and taken to the underworld. A lump of coal sounds pretty peachy in comparison. 11. Jews have been celebrating Hanukkah with menorahs and fried food for the past 19 centuries or so. It was only in the late 1880s that 8 nights of presents became part of the ritual. That's when 2 Reform rabbis in Cincinnati intentionally brought a Christmassy feel to the festivities, hoping to make Jewish children more connected with their synagogues by turning Hanukkah into a gift-giving holiday. It took off. Contrary to its pugilistic moniker, this is number 12, Boxing Day has nothing to do with prize fighting. It's actually a celebration of charitable giving held on the day after Christmas in the United Kingdom. The name comes from the ritual of opening the box, the alms box, in the local parish church and distributing the contents to the poor. Number 13. There's a reason December has so many holidays. You can thank the winter solstice, which is not only the shortest day of the year, but also kicks off 6 months during which sunset comes a little later every day and thus has been celebrated for thousands of years as a sort of birth of light. It is believed that when Christian religion began marking the birth of Jesus Christ at the end of the 3rd century, church officials chose December 25th to coincide with existing pagan solstice festivals, making it easier to persuade people to accept Christianity. Happy holidays! Who knew? And there's a picture in full color of a bunch of blobs and streaks of light and such. The anatomy of a sneeze. Simultaneously expressing herself as a solid, a liquid, and a gas, the common sneeze is one of nature's greatest miracle, grossest miracles. MIT researcher Linda Burable has a different name for sneezes, though. Violent expiratory events. That's also the title of a recent study in which her team analyzes sneezes, millisecond by millisecond, with a high-speed camera and sophisticated computer models. What did they find? There's more to a sneeze than what you see in your hanky, and that could influence our understanding of the way diseases spread. Here's a closer look at what scientists see when you say achoo. Number 1. Like a blast of birdshot, the initial jet phase of a sneeze lasts only milliseconds, but can send an estimated 40,000 droplets of various sizes scattering outward as fast as a car on a highway. Number 2. The largest droplets rocket out of the sneezer's mouth and rapidly plummet under their own weight within a few seconds. Average distance traveled, 3 to 6.5 feet. Number 3, in the puff phase of a sneeze, a turbulent cloud of warm, moist air swirls through the air, carrying the sneeze droplets with it. Number 4, the cloud grows and slows as it pulls in air from the environment, carrying the smallest droplets up to 26 feet from their point of origin. Number 5, buoyed by the cloud, small droplets can easily stay airborne long enough to reach overhead vents and thus anywhere in a building. It's a big problem, but there's a solution an arm's length away. Cover sneezes with a sleeve or tissue, wash your hands regularly, and keep those germs to yourself. Please. A quick humor in uniform. My 6-year-old was playing with his toy soldiers, using a different voice for each one. Soldier number 1, I have a bazooka and I make a big boom. Soldier number 2, I have a pistol that goes bang. Soldier number 3, I have a swifter and I can make your house really clean. The last soldier caught my attention. On further examination, I discovered that soldier, number 3, was holding a mind detector. And to kind of finish up, let's do a couple quick things from the Consumer Reports. I just saw coffee flower at the grocery store. What is it, and will it give me a caffeine buzz? Coffee beans are nestled inside a fruit called coffee cherry. After harvest, the edible fruit is often discarded, but some companies are now drying the cherry and grinding it into a soft flour, explains Maxine Siegel, RD, who heads CR's food lab. One perk of coffee flour is its sustainability. It takes 100 pounds of coffee cherries to make 20 pounds of coffee beans, according to the National Coffee Association. That's a lot of fruit that would be thrown away. It's nutritious, too. One tablespoon has 5 to 6 grams of fiber, but 5 times more than whole wheat flour, plus potassium and antioxidants. But don't expect it to turn cookies into health food, says Seregal, because the coffee flour can replace only up to 25% of the flour in baked goods. We made 2 batches of blueberry muffins and brownies in the CR test kitchen, one using the regular recipe and the other swapping 20% coffee flour for wheat flour. Then our taste experts did a blind taste test. The coffee flour muffins had a notably bitter taste, said Siegel, but we hardly noticed the difference in the brownies. For a quick health boost, try a tablespoon of coffee flour in a smoothie. You'll get a caffeine boost, too. One tablespoon has about 70 milligrams, the same as 6 ounces of black coffee. If someone collapses and I don't know CPR, what can I do after dialing 919? Often people hesitate to do CPR because they haven't had training, says Orly Avastor, MD, Medical Director for CR. But the willingness of bystanders to perform CPR can double or triple a cardiac arrest victim's chance of survival. Anyone untrained can use the effective technique called hands-only CPR, using chest compressions without mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Place the heel of your hand on the center of the person's chest, on the breastbone, with the other hand on top, then push down hard and fast. The chest should go down at least 2 inches, then rise fully. Keep a pace of 100 compressions per minute, humming the Bee Gees' Stayin' Alive, keeps the right rhythm. Thanks to Good Samaritan laws in every state, you are unlikely to be held liable in the event of a civil suit, as long as you acted in good faith. I see that genetic tablet chargers often cost less than ones sold in manufacturers, but do they work? Some cheaper third-party chargers can not only hurt your electronics, they can hurt you. The brick is packed full with digital circuitry designed to convert alternating current from the wall outlet into direct current needed to safely charge the lithium-ion battery in your device. This demanding rule is why chargers can feel warm during daily use. Chargers that come from the manufacturer are designed for your tablet. They also have quality components that go through rigorous testing. Because the UL standards are voluntary, many third-party chargers without the UL mark use inferior components that don't meet standards. So you got to be careful. And with that, we've run out of time for today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. We'd like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the Reading Service. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the Triangle Reading Service.